VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we're talking about the thrilling bank holiday weekend battle between Newcastle and West Ham and the other humdingers at Sheffield United and Chelsea. We'll also discuss Brentford's one-sided draw with Manchester United, and if we've got time, we might just mention the title race as well. Joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we've got the football writer and Sunday Times columnist Alison Rudd, a former footballer who once scored five goals over two legs for Gillingham in the 1987 playoff semi-final, which relegated Sunderland to the third tier for the first time in their history. It's Tony Cascarino. And another former footballer who got a bit overexcited after his Grimsby side beat Braintree in the 2016 National League playoffs and ended up breaking a light fitting in the dressing room during the celebrations. Gregor Robertson, keep those dance moves at bay today. Keep them to a minimum. Now, I know what you're thinking, you've dug me out again, but today's facts were all about Tony Cascarino, really. Tony, now you always say that facts not that well researched about your career, which I've got to say is true, because this one isn't that well researched either, because it comes from a listener, Kenny, who is a Sunderland fan, who's never forgiven you for those Gillingham heroics, those five goals in that rather bizarre playoff.
Yes, we won the home game 3-2 at Priestfield. I scored three. And the away game at Roker Park, as it was then, I scored two and we lost 4-3. But we went through on the away goals.
Yeah.
And I missed those.
And Sunderland away goals. And Sunderland were in the division above what is now the Championship.
Yes.
Right? And you, Gillingham and two other teams were in the playoffs in what was League One. So there's this bizarre thing where you played a team above you, right?
Yes, it was, yeah. And Sunderland was the team we met in the semi-final, if you like. And we got through that. Bob Stokoe was their manager. The weird thing about that game was that in the Gillingham end, or the away section, there was a number of Newcastle fans in there.
Dear.
Actually, everyone thought I was signing for Newcastle after that game. Never panned out. But yeah, it was. We lost the final. We won 1-0 at Priestfield and we lost 2-1 away. With the away goals, we should have gone through. But they then added an extra game, a playoff that was at Crystal Palace, and we lost 2-0 to Swindon.
So having had away goals for the semi-final,
yes,
they then
got
rid of
not the final, no.
Honestly, mental, and we think VAR's a problem in the modern game. Now, anyway, we were considering opening with an April Fool's gag and not mentioning the snooze fest at the Etihad at all. But we've decided at the Times we're more sophisticated than that. But we're not going to dwell too much on it, because it wasn't a thriller. Arsenal's performance in this game, though, means that they've taken 4 points off City this season and keeping them out at the Etihad, which not many teams can do. It might not have been pretty, but they do deserve some credit, don't they, Alison Rudd, for getting this result, Arsenal?
Yeah, I mean, it's a case of a manager knowing what his team are good at in the moment as well, I think.
Because, and what do you think that is that they're good at?
Well, what I think, what I've been impressed with most about Arsenal, there's a lot of things actually, but one thing is the way their defence just looks more cohesive, majestic, on top of things, game by game. And to go to the Etihad feeling that you have such faith in the way you set up defensively and the individual characters within that, that you can plan for the priority to be not to concede and then execute it. On some level, that's wise coaching, isn't it? And quite rightly, I think most people, because it was it was a very boring match, especially as it came after a very exciting one.
We'll come to it. We'll
I know you will. I know
worry.
You will. But it just felt... the problem... I actually don't blame Arteta for having that plan. He built on what's going really well for Arsenal at the moment, which is their defence. And you could say, well, couldn't you have taken it a step further, been a little more adventurous on the pitch? Well, no, because he had a plan of action. What surprised me was that Pep Guardiola almost you know, like in an old-fashioned Western, just sort of gave up, put his hands in the air. He said, you can't press against a team when they're playing that well in that manner. So do something else, please, Pep, which he didn't really do. So the onus was on City to make that, to come up with ways through the Arsenal defence, and they couldn't. So the moral winners of that contest were Arsenal.
Kudos for following through with your impression this time, unlike that time you were going to do Ange Postecoglou's Australian accent and bottled it at the last minute. But I'm glad we got a cowboy accent out of you in the end. Gregor, just talking about Arsenal's defence, what were you more impressed by? The kind of non-fullbacks of Kiriol and Ben White, or the two, you know, huge, big characters in centre defence of Saliba and Gabriel?
The whole collective. Those two guys kind of shone, because essentially what Arsenal were doing were defending the goal, defending the box, allowing play to be... Manchester City often got the ball into Arsenal's box in the sort of like little outside channels, but Arsenal trusted White and Kiwior and their wingers who were doubling up to deal with that. And if the ball did come in the box, they trusted their two centre-half colossus to head it clear or to out-muscle Erling Haaland. But it was all about that kind of collective and closing space, being really compact and only allowing Manchester City kind of into their final third in the areas they wanted to let them do that. And Man City are great at opening up those little avenues, those little channels between fullback and centre half. You know, getting little players in little pockets of space there and interplay and carving their way through. They just weren't able to do that. The only way they could get through Arsenal at all was down the side, and they weren't really through them. It was like White and Kiwior were really... I thought White was outstanding in particular.
Yeah, Tony, what do you make of the game?
Well, it was quite weird. Before the game, I spoke to James, obviously our boss, and he said to me, your column today, I'd like you to do a piece just on Arsenal at Manchester City. And I thought, oh yeah, great, that's fine.
And you normally cover the whole weekend.
Yeah, the weekend. I normally have a mixture of Saturday games and obviously Liverpool-Brighton, and then... So I'm watching the game and I'm thinking, oh no, this is going to be really tough. How am I going to get through this? Because obviously what Alisson and Gregor just spoke about was the outstanding features of the game was Arsenal's defending. How brilliantly they marshalled every part of the pitch from the centre of midfield to out wide to deny City and make City look very ordinary. And then I started to think, well, I've got to think outside the box here, because literally there wasn't much in the attacking sense. No goalkeeper made any save of any sorts. Set pieces weren't a part of, which were a big part of the conversation before the game. Was set pieces are fundamental in this game to a team making a difference? Nothing at all.
Yeah, in terms of the attacking sense, then, your former Republic of Ireland teammate Roy Keane talking about Erling Haaland in slightly disparaging terms on Sky Sports. But why do you think he was struggling? You know, he's never got loads and loads of touches in this City team, when he's been scoring. But do you think he's having a more difficult season? Is it the injuries? Is City not as good?
He missed 2 months of the season, and then you can add in Kevin De Bruyne, who was out for probably closer to 4 to 5 months, which is obviously his main man for assists. I think it's a frustrating team for him at times, and especially yesterday, where expectation on him to deliver with very few touches and everything was crowded. And as Gregor was talking about inside the box, well, there wasn't really anything on, because Arsenal seemed to be in every position where the ball could go to, seemed to be a defender. Mm. And they'd clear it, they'd give away a corner. You know, and I did feel like, I wonder how long, because there was a clear frustration from him. And it's hard to criticise a centre forward when the modern game only play one up front. Most teams have one. And I'm telling you, as a centre forward, it's much easier to have a partner. Mm. Someone to... Now, what you could say, Alvarez on the bench, bringing him on, maybe stretch Arsenal or trying to, you know, exploit something in their back line. He never really had anything to deal with. And I think that's the most frustrating place for a centre forward. Saying him looking being average, or... I mean, I don't know Keane's exact words.
League two player, he called him.
Sorry?
He said it's like his other play outside scoring goals, his other play is like that of a League Two striker.
He's not much of League Two, Roy, I can tell you.
That is maybe part of the reason why Keane didn't really do it as a manager. Sorry. If you think he's League Two in any shape or form, he's clearly not.
No.
I mean, Gary, this Gary is always slagged him off as well, though.
Yeah.
Everyone was slagging him off.
Yeah, but this has always been the case for Haaland. It's ever since he joined, he's having to go in games and have like 10 touches and a half of football or whatever, going like half an hour without hardly touching the ball, and then being ready and always concentrated and alert enough and like professional enough to switch on, to be explosive in the right moment, to provide the killer touch in the right moment. And he's always done it. And, you know, in the games where he doesn't, it makes him look like, not a League Two player, but it makes him look like a frustrated figure, which is understandable. He's also playing against, you know, lower defensive blocks than he will ever have faced at other teams in his career. You know, playing for a more dominant team than he will have ever have played for in his career. But he's always said, if I score the goals, if I make the sterling contributions, I'm happy. And look, it took them to the treble last year. I think I said at the start when he first joined, after watching a couple of games, I was blown away by, like, can he possibly sustain this? Can he possibly be happy being one of the best strikers in the world and having as little involvement as he's having? And he has.
Mm.
He's managed.
So far.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, you have a valid point. I wonder whether he can do that, whether he wants to stay with City for 5 years for this very reason.
I can't see that.
Possibly, but he just won the treble last year and they might still win the Premier League title in third gear.
So if this League Two player gets sold, what price are we putting on this League Two player?
If he's going to League Two, not very much,
I'm saying. No, but you get what I mean. I mean, I don't like the exaggeration of where you go from a player who isn't particularly had a good game, but then which City player would have said from yesterday was outstanding?
Mm. Yeah, well, I mean, that's why I started with Arsenal, wasn't it? Because the game was dictated by how Arsenal played. I wanted to come back to that just very quickly for you and Gregor, Tony. In terms of elite side, well, any side, that kind of a performance, is it drilled in through the week in training, or is this something that we've seen from Arsenal the whole season? Has this been part of their makeup this season, do you think?
Well, I would have assumed at the start of the season there would have been an inquest into what were the failings of the season before. And it was quite easy. Arsenal were easy to roll over, which happened in their running. That they had a few defeats. I pretty much mentioned Southampton. I think Brentford had a victory against them. And their performances would have concerned them that maybe we need a steely team. With the injection of, obviously, Rice, and then you put Jorginho and Havertz in there, that are all willing runners and good players technically. I think that's obviously paid huge dividends. But there's also been, their back four is really four centre-halves.
Hmm.
And that's it. They're not natural full-backs, but they are very good at defending. I mean, Gregor would probably tell you this as well. And many a time in football clubs, you have defence against attack. Yeah, Gregor?
Mm-hmm.
Matches. Do you know the defenders win way more than the forwards,
really?
Generally, because they stop the goals going in and they always find a weldy from 25 yards. But I always found the defenders against the attackers wouldn't defend as well. You know, they would be worse than the defenders being good going forward.
Yeah.
And score many worldies, Gregor, in training?
Oh, loads, yeah.
But do you know what I mean, Gregor? The defenders didn't they?
Yeah.
Often beat the forwards in a five-a-side match or a match in general.
Yeah, it's all about being like, they'll have been drilled for all season. There's two things. One is, this is like, as Tony was saying there, it's like a change in their approach. From the very start of the season, they wanted to exhibit more control over every game they played in. Look, they've not had to play like this very often.
No.
This is a unique game plan for a unique opponent. But just, they've been working on staying so compact, closing space down, having, you know, Rice has been a huge thing in front of the two centre halves, and having them fit and staying fit all season has been a game changer for them. So it was like, there's a lot to admire about it. As I said, it's kind of, there is a little lingering doubt about whether they might come to regret not doing a little bit more to try and win the game against a team, an opponent that was kind of certainly not at their full flowing best, shall we say. They haven't been for much of the season. As I said, I think they could still win the Premier League title. I still think they will win the Premier League title, before you ask me that, Tom. And like, having really left third gear.
Well, I'm going to come back and ask you it deliberately again after we talked about Liverpool, because one team who have got their best players back and scoring are Liverpool. Jurgen Klopp's team beating Brighton 2-1 with goals from Mo Salah and Luis Diaz. Now, Alisson, you've talked a lot on the podcast this season about never ever being worried when Liverpool go behind. So it's Easter Sunday. Got the family around, I assume. Everyone watching this game, and then Brighton take the lead. Not worried?
No, not at all. In fact, I was ready to walk into the living room to watch it with my family, and I heard a noise which sounded like someone shouting goal, and I was surprised because kickoff wasn't for another sort of few seconds. But I wasn't surprised because I thought, you know, clock's changing. It might be my fault. I've got the time completely wrong.
It's actually half time.
But the fact that someone I thought was shouting goal so early wouldn't have been a shock is just some... That basically to me sums up what it must be like for every other Liverpool fan as well. It was not a surprise. And sure enough, that it happened, very early goal. And I was not surprised. I mean, it's a strange place to be in because for most of my life, you know, if you watch a game where you have a vested interest or some emotional connection, to concede an early goal and makes you sort of groan, you know, you feel, oh no, what does this mean? Is this going to be one of those awful afternoons where you just concede and have we set up wrong? Oh, what's going wrong here? The opposition in amazing form, what's happening? Liverpool concede so often, it really almost is a given. It's almost pleasant. Because you know the response will be a star.
Pleasant. Oh, how lovely. How wonderful.
I don't mind at all.
How big is your living room, Al? Because you say you sort of walk and then the game kicks off. It makes it sound like it's really huge.
Yeah, come on, Tone. You've heard about all the flags hanging from all those windows. If you're going to hang all the flags for teams in the World Cup, you've got to have a pretty big gaff.
It's all set up for a five-a-side afterwards, yeah.
Lovely. Gregor, in terms of to counter Alisson, you've been worried at times. Early in the season, you said Liverpool defensively, that's what will undermine them. As the season progressed, you've kind of seen the strengths kind of winning out against those weaknesses. When it comes to the run-in, do you agree with Alisson that this is now the pattern they've settled into now, where concede doesn't really matter, it'll all be a bit mad, we'll win in the end? Or do you think it might come back and bite them at some point in the next 9 games?
I mean, it is a pattern. It's not a pattern that they'll, you know, want to embrace. It's like...
But you do half wonder whether they've embraced it.
Look, they'll be enjoying the fact that they can always seem to muster something and find a way to win. But I think they would also enjoy winning 3-0 and 4-0 and, you know, 5-6-0 like Arsenal were. Yeah, until recently. So,
but we did that. We did that. So, let's score 8 or 9 and then go on a goal drought. You've got to eke it out.
So it's easy to think that they're a little bit more on the knife edge in the running. Like there's, you know, the margin for error is smaller. But there is some sort of kind of, I don't know, like a emotional energy that seems behind Liverpool.
Blackmail.
This time.
No, sorry, did I say that out loud?
There's something behind them this year. It was evident when they played a load of youth team players. It was stirred up by Klopp's announcement that he's going to leave, and it's been evident in the sort of emergence of some of their signings who've been really effective. Between now and the end of the season, if they keep going behind, it's hard to think that they can find something in every game, because there's no margin for error. That's the thing.
No.
You know, one team could win all 8 or 9 games left. What have they got?
Yeah, 8, 9 games each.
See, Liverpool have an incredible mentality, as in, it's really hard to get a group of players that everyone will run every inch of the pitch on every given occasion. They do that all over the pitch. And you might say, well, yes, of course, Arsenal do that, and they did that at the Etihad against City, and City just generally have that. But there's something a bit more... It's weird watching Liverpool. As a fan of the club, I'm on edge all the time with them. What I saw at Manchester United, I keep thinking, that's been coming. Hmm. You know, that 4-3 loss in the cup.
So you don't find it pleasant?
Well, no, I find it like... Liverpool's way is that it's so brave. At times it feels crazily brave, but then they were playing against a team that are brave as well. Mm. So it suited Liverpool that, yes, they played a low block, but Brighton defended really well for the first half and always offered with Odinga on the left-hand side, always offered a threat, and the way they got their goal, they took it brilliantly. But Liverpool are a team that seem to play fearless football in any part of the pitch. and can carry it off 9 times out of 10. But I have also said many occasions, there's a hammering in there somewhere, because I just feel it's going to be a day where Keller is not going to pull off a save, or Alisson likewise before. Liverpool have taken, I mean, I know you're big on your XG and chances for opposition, Greg, but teams create a lot of chances against Liverpool.
Yeah, well, it wasn't all good news for Liverpool fans. It wasn't all pleasant. Alisson Rudd, news this weekend that Xabi Alonso, oh no, he's not coming home. How terribly sad. Sorry, I don't know why I'm being so pointed. I just thought to, you know, to balance things out a little bit. But he's not coming, not this season at least. So that leaves Liverpool in a little bit of a pickle, doesn't it? And it was interesting reading Roberto De Zerbi's comments after this match, the Brighton manager, talking about needing to see the plan, something that he's talked about with Brighton before, kind of putting the pressure back on Tony Bloom and the club officials to kind of make sure he's backed. Could you see Roberto De Zerbi stepping into Xabi Alonso's shoes? Alison?
Well, it's not meant to be impossible. I think it would be a mistake. I find De Zerbi a fantastic manager of another club, not mine, basically.
Right.
He's incredibly emotional, but I would say over-emotional. He's not someone who thinks about the politics of the right and wrong things to say. If he thinks the referee's had a bad game, he will just say so in a rather excessively flowery way and get into trouble for it. And most recently, ever since they lost in the Europa League to Roma 4-0, he's had little pops at the ownership. I mean, it's amazing he's not been sacked, actually, because you don't do that. You just do not have regular... You're allowed one in the heat of the moment to say, or maybe, you know, it's not just me. The ownership of the club need to think about what they're doing. He's had regular pops now at Tony Bloom, who most people would argue has run the club very cleverly, astutely. So there's two things going on. One is De Zerbi seems to be setting himself up for a move, letting people know he's not entirely happy and that if he's going to stay, things have to change. But I can see why he's linked to clubs as big as Liverpool and others equally big across Europe. He seems to be the guy, because his impact at Brighton was phenomenal, and there is a bravery to the way he sets up his teams. But he's an erratic, emotional character who occasionally, and his results this season haven't been great. I just feel it's I could see it going wrong. I could see the pressures of the job, and Anfield is already an emotional place. It doesn't need him to inject that extra layer of emotion. I think it could combust and be quite peculiar, actually. If I was in charge, I wouldn't pick him.
Right. Alisson's turned down Roberto De Zerbi. Tony, who are you picking?
The one I've always liked, because of what he's achieved at Brentford, is Thomas Frank. I think he's really adaptable to the way he comes up against different styles and is prepared to play a different way against them. It can be pragmatic and it can be really aggressive. He's had to deal with a ridiculous amount of injuries. We were off air talking, you know, from fullbacks to Mbeumo, no Ivan Toney, losing the goalkeeper at the start of the season, Raya moving on, it's only on loan at Arsenal. But just generally, they've been affected so much, more than any other team, with not the biggest squad. I love the way he talks after games. I think he's always quite pragmatic and he plays brave style of football.
Well, that was evident against Manchester United. We might bring that in now, because it was a brilliant performance against Manchester United, and not necessarily the direct way that Brentford sometimes play against the bigger teams.
It could be both.
Yeah, definitely. But I thought, Alisson, that his demeanour on the touchline and his interview afterwards, after that game against Manchester United, where he said, oh, we completely played them off the park. I might have even been able to smile even if we'd lost, but I'm not sure why. I mean, he's just an incredibly likable character, isn't he?
Yeah, I've been fortunate to have two long one-on-one interviews with him since he joined Brentford. And he is... I've been doing this job 30 years nearly, and he's up there in the top five people where you come away thinking, well, he's just great. He's amazing. He doesn't put a foot wrong. He's first of all, when you chat to him, he's not playing a game. He's not putting forward the version of himself he thinks you want to hear from. He's just himself. He's incredibly down to earth, open, honest, which is amazing in itself that a Premier League manager would be like that. I mean, he even said to me in one interview, I might not bother might not bother carrying on coaching for too long. He might want to do other things. You know, people. It's not a political thing to say, but it was the honest thing to say in that moment. That's how he felt. He's. People have said, I think Gregor said it, that maybe his style of football doesn't suit Liverpool. Because I'm with Tony. I think if I have to pick someone now, I'd think, well, I wouldn't be disappointed if they went for Thomas Frank. Because I think he's intelligent enough to know what he could do with the group of players he would inherit. The football you get from Brentford is always the best version of A, who the opposition are, and B, who he has available for him. And it can be all things. It can be three at the back, five at the back, four at the back. Some of the football against Manchester United was of the sort where you go, oh, that was lovely. Really crisp, clever, one-touch passing where everyone knew what they were meant to be doing. It was fearless. I mean, they'd already known what it's like to beat Man United 4-0. They didn't have any fear. It's really interesting, you know, how far has Ten Hag progressed from that battering from Brentford? Not a lot, it would seem. He's much more than a plucky manager who just manages to scrape by with the resources. It's always inventive. And I would also argue, if you were going to try and do a sort of put together a puzzle, pick a quality from all the Premier League managers you admire and put them into one person, you might end up with Thomas Frank if you did that.
Interesting. High praise indeed. Now, well, Gregor, you've mentioned it already and you've already picked your team. Not changing your mind? City still for the title?
Yeah, although my faith was eroded not long ago and it's been eroded a little bit further, but I still think they'll do it. Yeah.
Are you sticking to the matter of stubborn Scottishness or are you just sticking that to them because you believe?
Bit of both.
Yeah, fair enough. Tony, who's going to win the title? 9 games left.
I've been waiting a long time for City to turn up because I think they will.
With nine games is still left. A long time.
No, it's not. But it wouldn't surprise me if they won 8, if not 9. Obviously, I've been avoiding mentioning Liverpool season. I'm staying that way and they're still top Liverpool, so I'm staying with City.
2 for City. Alison.
Well, it's not really because Tony doesn't actually mean that. Breaking news.
He's going for the reverse jinx, is he?
Exactly.
Unlike you, who are going for a very pleasant title-winning stroll for Jurgen Klopp.
It will be lovely. Well,
all you famous and clever pundits have always said various different cliches down the years, and one of them is that defences win titles, which is why I'm backing Mikel Arteta's side and Arsenal to triumph. Now, if you're a listener like Kenny, who we mentioned earlier in the show, with a grudge against one of our former players and pundits, like Tony Cascarino, or if you've got other views you want to share with us, like who might win the title, then get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. But stick with us, we're talking West Ham, Newcastle and Chelsea next.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.
Hello and welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark and today I'm joined by Tony Cascarino, Alison Rudd and Gregor Robertson. Now, we've talked about all the boring matches near the top of the table, all these teams being nervy and things like that. To St James's Park, Newcastle 4, West Ham 3. This was an absolute cracker, wasn't it, Gregor? I'm going to go in and ask you a question early because my first thought, I always think of you when I'm watching football. All the time.
Thanks.
I'm thinking, I hope he's happy. I hope he's out there living his best life. And I know one thing that does make you happy, and that's Harvey Barnes back on a football pitch.
It's great to see. Joyous. yeah, they've missed them. They really have missed them. And
amazing goals. I thought when I saw the goals go in and then watched the highlights, I was expecting a guy back from injury, maybe off the bench, he might have deflected, you know, little tap in or something. But the nature of the goals, you know, the really power, energetic and power. All, yeah. Didn't look like someone who's been out for months.
God,
injured.
No. And when he was sliding on his knees in the corner flag. Yeah. Yeah, that look, that's exactly what he's known for and what he's best at is getting, you know, starting out left and driving in field and making things happen, linking play and getting shots off. His second goal is an absolute beauty. Great moment for him and for Newcastle and for Eddie Howe, who's obviously, you know, pressure is starting to rise on him a little bit. But yeah, I think they'll need him because of so many, the players are dropping like flies. We've spoken about Brentford with injury troubles and other clubs and like across the board this season, really. There's been a lot of injuries, but Newcastle really are. They lost Almiro and they lost Lascelles in this game, on top of all the rest. So,
and they've had Tonali out as well. Not an injury, of course, but still missing him for most of the season.
Botman's out with an ACL as well. So, yeah, big player. So, his return is most welcome.
When it comes to your long-standing best mate, Harvey Barnes, and your new best mate, Gordon, do you think they can play in the same team? Or are they both competing for the same spot?
They're definitely both competing for the same spot. I think one of the main reasons Gordon has played so well this season is that Harvey Barnes arrived in the summer. I think it's easy to forget that Gordon had a really difficult time to his Newcastle career, when he signed the January before. And I think the arrival of someone of Barnes' stature, you know, England international. Like, if Barnes is fit and playing at a top club and playing at his very best and producing the numbers he can, there's like, I always thought he was in that conversation. It's just he's never been able to stay fit long enough to sort of maintain a kind of momentum to get back in that. You know, he got an England cap, but I don't know if that's gone now. I don't know if that's maybe gone for him now, but I always thought he was good enough. He's so powerful, so good at running with the ball. Really, really dynamic player, and that's his best position. So if they can play in the same team, I think it would be Gordon on the other side as opposed to Barnes. I think that Gordon's maybe got a little bit more kind of ability to go down the line, I think. Right. I think Barnes' strength is going in and linking play. One-twos. So that's what he always did with Leicester. Driving in field, one-twos, goals, creating goals. That's what he's best at.
Yeah, one player who definitely got showing off his skills of carrying the balls, Mohamed Kudus of West Ham. Tony, is one of the reasons this game was so great, not just because it was 4-3 and packed with incidents, because it was an example of what the Premier League has in its strengths in terms of, you know, we've talked about the big six teams, the top six teams, these two teams just outside that, and yet they're packed with really, really talented attacking players, aren't they?
Yeah, well, considering that West Ham under David Moyes are considered quite a boring team, and you look at Paqueta and you look at Kudus and you look at Bowen, you think there's a lot to be said there. He's brilliant at shielding the ball. You know, he gets his body across a midfielder that's trying to rob it off him. He, like Gazza, he gets his upper body strength, holds them off, and then gets half a yard, and he drives. You know, Gregor was talking there about Harvey Barnes driving forward. He does that really well as well. It's really effective. And I've got to be honest, for the first hour of the game, West Ham were terrific. They looked like they were going to hurt Newcastle on a number of occasions. Being able to just break that high line that Newcastle had at times, getting behind the first goal was that, when it with Antonio.
What changed then? Was it
Antonio coming off was the major change? 3-1 up. Antonio gets substituted. I never understand, and it sometimes frustrates me when. And this is where you can look at David Moyes and say, this is why West Ham fans question you, is not because of your position in the league, not because you're European. You know, you won a European trophy, or you're going well this season. It's because decisions that they find strange. That I sort of felt, do you know, David, I would have just gone like for like. Put Ings on. Play Ings, keep your shape. Newcastle were there for the taking to go 4-5-1. You didn't have to change too much. And when Calvin Phillips come on, West Ham lost their way, and giving the ball away. You don't need a lot at St James's Park to lift that crowd. If it was going to go 3-2, you pretty much knew that 3-3 was coming and maybe worse. Because it changed the whole dynamics of a football match.
But if it hadn't been Calvin Phillips, that could have been seen as very astute management, because Newcastle were missing good chances. It looked like Newcastle were going to come back into that game, and he has a two-goal cushion to protect. And normally you think, well, I'm away from home, they're missing chances. That we got lucky there. Let's just try and calm things down. And you bring on a fully fit, fully confident central midfielder to shore things up. The mistake I think Moyes made is in thinking the next game will be the game where Phillips proves his worth, and he doesn't because he's off the pace. I don't want to add to the boy's woes because he's getting a lot of grief, but Moyes seems to see something that no one else can see. I don't think the decision was wrong. I think the personnel was wrong.
Okay, I would say to that that I have no problem him bringing on Calvin Phillips. It's who he takes off. If you're bringing a centre forward off, I think just keep your shape. Newcastle weren't a team you'd have to really think hard about. They were quite basic in the way they were playing and quite easy to break down. I just felt keep your centre forward there. If you want to change a midfielder, take Ward-Prowse off, put Calvin Phillips on. That's all fine. But once they brought Antonio off, and there was no focal point of the forward line, it felt to me that you were inviting traffic all the time coming forward, inviting players to keep coming at you. And that's what happened in the game.
But what does Moyes see in Phillips?
Well, he's hoping he sees the player he was at Leeds.
But that's the weird bit.
Yeah. I mean, I felt sorry for him because obviously I'm sure you're going to talk about the penalty and how unjust it was a lot's going wrong for him. You know,
but that was the thing I was going to ask in relation to Alisson's point. And we've talked about lots of different players before. Both of you said, you know, when things are going bad as a player, you just want to play and get one good game under your belt. But how long can you play badly and keep being in the spotlight, as Alisson said, giving away the goal on his debut against Bournemouth, a couple of other clangers, giving away the penalty before you go, actually, I need to take you out of the spotlight here?
He has been taken out of the spotlight. It's not like he's starting them. It's a vicious circle for him. He needs the game time to get to the level that we all know he's capable of. But when he does get the game time, it's kind of denting his confidence, and that means that he's less likely to get more game time, and then the circle continues. So I think he's he'll do well to make much of this loan move at all now between now and end of the season.
Does it feel, Gregor, to you? And we're bringing everybody here. Does it feel like a similar sort of scenario to Danny Drinkwater when he went from Leicester to Chelsea and it all went wrong for him early on, and then suddenly his performances got poorer?
It's having that long. Having that long without regular football. It's been a long time. And some players can cope with that better than others. Although there's not many players want to go like a year and a half without playing any minutes, really. Yeah. So he's made a mistake. I understand it. You want to stay in, it was part of a hugely successful squad last season. You think you're going to get an opportunity. You think when my chance comes, we were talking about Harry Maguire not long ago. Why did he not take a move? Why did he not do this? Because he thought he could stay and fight. I mean, an opportunity arose, he'd grab it. The opportunity very rarely arose for him at Man City. And now it's proven to be a mistake.
I think it's because he took the number 11 shirt. Don't be a defensive midfielder and wear number 11. You're only asking for trouble, aren't you? They should be number 4, number 6, maybe number 8, or one of the 20s or something. Don't be like number 11 playing as a DM. That's a terrible decision.
Don't talk about DMs, Tom.
Why?
It's what the kids do.
DM's not that, not that modern, I think. I think we're way past that. Now, Alisson, you've written in your Sunday Times column this week, riffing on your Q&A debate with Gregor and with Times readers last week, talking about VAR and saying that other than line calls, should get rid of it. And in light of these decisions, that penalty, Calvin Phillips, is that the kind of a decision that you're talking about, that VAR is scrutinising too much to the nth degree and spoiling the game?
Yeah, I mean, my head exploded, to be quite honest, and it's a miracle I'm sat here. But then it is Easter.
It's a good bandage you've got on your head, though. Yeah. To be fair,
no, it's like, well, first of all, I don't believe it is a penalty. The referee watching it, good view of it, didn't think it was a penalty, and then he's asked to go to the monitor. Voices in his ear saying, oh, if you look at it in this way or that way, maybe it is a penalty. In what possible way has VAR added to the game of football in that instance? They've found, it's almost like they've forensically analysed something to find a way to make it a penalty when it wasn't. And the whole idea of I just don't think football is geared to this sort of forensic analysis at all, because there is no truth in football. It's all about interpretation. There are some obvious examples of fact, but this sort of incident is a prime example of the referee in the context of the game, speed of the game, passion of the game, players involved. He decides it's not a penalty. If you slow something down enough, look at it enough. And it still remained interpretive to me, even from all the different angles. And my interpretation was that it was not a penalty. I just do not see how stopping the game and then awarding a penalty in that instance is in any way helping to progress the game of football, helping the players, helping the fans, helping us enjoy it more. It feels unjust. It feels horrible, and it's unnecessary. I mean, we should strip it back, strip all the assistants back, so that it's that sort of analysis is not required, wanted, and not part of the game at all. In my column, I did say that I'd been to Stockley Park and seen all these screens of slow down fouls, so they looked like you were watching various Vietnam War films all around the room, because slow down, everything looks horrific, looks like a crime. And I've been invited back to Stockley Park because they're not doing that now. Mm. They do still slow things down, but the priority is real-time analysis. I hope that's true, and I hope to go back and see that for myself. But in this instance, and it happens in lots of games, there's no way the referee is being asked to rethink this without there being a forensic slowing down of the action. And I just don't think football is a suitable sport for it to happen. This is not what football wants to achieve, even. I find it illogical and upsetting.
Gregor, as a man, you must have tried to hoof the ball clear from your own penalty box a number of times. Sympathy with this decision, or do you think it's a penalty?
I think it's the voice of the nation
on VAR, Gregor Robertson.
I know, it is tiresome, isn't it? I mean, God, me. I think that unless we're going to start calling that for what it is, which is like simulation, despite Calvin Phillips making clear, you know, booting his calf, booting him in the leg, but we're still willing to say, hang on, he put his leg in that position intentionally to be kicked. It's not a surprise that they gave the penalty kick. Like, the thing that made this, you know, remarkable was that Gordon wasn't. He kind of got his foot in the position where it was the wrong way around to then control the ball afterwards. Do you know what I mean? He kind of swiveled his body around, and he was almost facing Phillips rather than, and the ball was on the other side. So like, it was so blatant. That's the thing, but Phillips kicked him. When you get your body in between a player and the ball, and the player kicks you, crikey, these days you're giving the referee a pretty easy decision to make.
Well, I'm not trying to make you further exasperated, but let's move on to another game with another soft penalty decision. Chelsea against Burnley, Mikhailo Mudryk into the box, a slight little caress of the shoulder from the Burnley defender. Alison Rudd, you were there at Stamford Bridge. In real time, did you shout, that's a penalty?
Or
did you
in real time? I thought... Lorenz Asignon, that's a very good piece of defending, is what I thought. And I was aghast that a penalty was given. And then you get down to the philosophical point of VAR. They don't intervene because it's not an outrageous decision. Who decides what's outrageous? What percentage points do you give? I mean, ridiculous. So you've got VAR doing, across the weekend, doing everything wrong, really, in my book. They've intervened when they shouldn't, and when they should, they don't, because they don't want to make the referee look weak. It's an absolute joke. But at least in this instance, although it was the wrong, I don't know, how do you decide it's wrong? I think 98 out of 100 football fans would say it wasn't a penalty. Would that make it wrong?
Why not? Stabbing the dark at a fact there. Yeah, I'm going
because
to
because the two exist.
But because there's two, then
they don't overturn.
The VAR can't say that it was a clear and obvious error. It's a ludicrous position.
And I dragged you in on Bank Holiday Monday and I made you talk about VAR. So selfish of me. Let's move on to talk about the actual football at Stamford Bridge, Alison. Because what that decision did do was that it seemed to galvanise a Burnley team to show some characteristics that perhaps they haven't shown this season. I thought it was quite interesting, Craig Bellamy, the assistant manager, talking after the game because of Vincent Kompany's red card, about how the players all united behind this injustice. And that was exactly what drove them on to get this draw.
Yeah, I mean, I think some people were speculating that had there not been, if it remained 11 against 11, then maybe Chelsea would have won, because Burnley did find reserves of characteristics. I've not seen them display too much this season, and I've been critical of them, but I wouldn't be critical of them after this. They use that sense of injustice and indignation to really find energy levels that were commendable. At no point at all, because it was the 40th minute, so in the second half, at no point at all did I think, oh, that's a team with 10 men who are tiring. Oh, there's a bit of a hole there on the pitch because they've only got 10 men. Oh, no point were you reminded in terms of the football that they were down to 10 men. And so that's deserving of praise. And they remained keen to attack. They were quite fearless in attack. They were the team most likely to win the game.
And they nearly did win it, of course.
And nearly did win it. Rodriguez hit the post, hit the crossbar. So, I mean, that astonishing. And if I've written Burnley off for being naive this season, but if this is the last chance saloon, Easter represents your last chance to do something to give you hope when you're down the bottom. If company can somehow bottle that, what they showed at the Stamford Bridge, and apply it for the rest of the season, there is some slim chance for them.
Can't believe you didn't make a resurrection gag then. sorry, Gregor. 4 points.
4 points, yeah. They're still 4 points away from safety. Yeah. Like, even Sheffield United are seven with a game in hand.
Mm.
Like, I don't know. I just looked at the bottom of the table after, you know, everything's now kind of settled itself down with the points deductions and all that speculation. It's like, this is the lie of the land. And they're in it.
Well, let's come back to the bottom of the table very quickly, because Tony, I want to ask you about Chelsea and some of the things that Alison talked about there. When you flip them on its head, praising Burnley, you then have to criticise Chelsea, don't you? And I think is there a slight apathy creeping in amongst Chelsea fans where you, at this home game, Alison, probably you should answer more of this as
Without
well,
doubt.
Where they're going, I don't even know what we are anymore. 11th in the table.
I'll give you an explanation to something that I find quite weird about Chelsea. Is nearly every one of their players in every position is new player to the football club, and they've all got a healthy new contract. And they play like a team, all on new contracts. Okay, now, Greg is laughing here with me.
It's because he never got more than a two-year deal.
We've both been in where there is a bit of anger within a group. Like, some boys are not paid or been rewarded with new deals. And Chelsea are the perfect opposition for a Burnley type of scenario. They are the perfect team to play. Up against 10 men, you look at the opposition and you feel like these give you a chance. This Chelsea gives you a chance on every level. Everything about Chelsea at the moment, and you mentioned off the field, even the crowd are sort of not really that bothered. It's going wrong, and they don't get that angry. They listen a bit to their manager, Poch, who's asking for no more boos. They just feel like a club that's totally in a comfort zone in every level.
Alison, is that Stamford Bridge atmosphere, would you agree with Tony's assessment?
Well, it's like when you've had a massive row with your partner and then there's that lull afterwards and you just go sit in separate rooms and don't talk to each other. It felt like that a bit, because Pochettino had sort of called out the fans, asking for them to be more supportive. They had been booing Raheem Sterling, and when he came on, he got cheers, but they were clearly ironic and pointed cheers. They were sort of saying, okay, we'll do what you say. There was no negative chanting. I would say that Chelsea fans were giving it the best they could in the circumstances. Even at the final whistle, they booed, but it was like
muted. Like,
it was
booze,
like,
yeah.
What's the point? And then
fake boos,
almost,
fake
but almost. And then you get the really radical thing that happened. Given that the only thing that Pochettino can cling to through all this, in terms of praise he gets, is how avuncular he is and how protective he is, and he's always stressing how young his players are, and they're all giving them they're giving
yeah, but they
everything.
They don't like that.
Well,
the fans are used to
no,
some
the fans
like,
don't like
dastardly
that at all,
blooming winning machine
but objectively,
kind of evil.
Away from the fan base, it's a quality that Pochettino has had through his career.
Yeah, but again, it's another example of the sort of contrast between the Chelsea of old and the Chelsea of new.
Absolutely, couldn't agree more. But he basically slagged off the players, and I've not seen him do that before. He said they lacked he touched his heart, so he lacked heart, and then he touched his head, and they lacked that, and you think, well, what's left? They've got no heart, no courage, and no brain. What's left?
A 7-year contract, as Tony Cascarino said. With that in mind, Alison Rudd, and all of us, Mauricio Pochettino, will he still be Chelsea manager in the summer? I'm voting no.
I'm voting no because he's slagged off the players now.
Tony?
No, yeah.
No, yeah.
No, I
maybe.
Can I have a line with that? I've got a line with that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you've asked nicely.
No,
De Zerbi you talked about earlier and the jobs. There's a lot of jobs that could be available this summer, from Manchester United to West Ham, from Chelsea, most definitely, and obviously we know Liverpool.
De Zerbi is a good fit.
Okay.
For Chelsea.
It's a club that make a lot of decisions and are badly timed. And I think Chelsea are going to make another badly timed decision on Poch.
And then get in De Zerbi.
No, he doesn't deserve me.
No, good. Honestly, now I know how Teddy Sheringham feels. I felt like I was passing the ball to you across the box for a tap in there. Gregor, Poch, yes or no?
Yes.
You hate predictions so much, which is why we're coming on to the relegation scrap, because Gregor Robertson, you mentioned it there. Even Sheffield United are still in it. They could have been in it even more had they held on to that win against Fulham. We mentioned VAR very quickly. Anyone know what that offside two phases of play stood in front of the keeper nonsense was all about?
No idea.
No.
Nope.
Good. 3-3. Chris Wilder, someone that you know quite well, Tony. Is he showing some signs of, whether it's this season or into next season, potentially in the Championship? They've had a very, very difficult season on and off the pitch, as Greg has consistently highlighted. They had a terrible pre-season. Does it feel like a bit of a rebuild is starting?
Well, I would say that I've seen in the away performances against Bournemouth, where they were obviously pegged back. I saw them at Crystal Palace, which I thought they were really good in the game. Luton away, they done really well. There's been some inspirational performances. I think the bringing in Brereton Diaz has added to them. It's given them a bit more of an edge up front alongside Ollie McBurnie. Incredible they didn't get 3 points at the weekend. Yeah. But the whole idea is building the club. He's building the club now. Sort of, he took over a club in League One. They were in a dismal shape. They're going down from the Premier League. They'll go in the Championship. I'm sure of that. But it will be loanees and relatively cheap signings what they'll look at to try and have a team to come back in the Premier League.
Look, there's been some encouraging performances recently, but like the shot count was 24-8, and they had and that in Fulham's favour, and Fulham had 73% of the ball. Like, Chelsea United got themselves in a great position. I'm not sure how they got themselves in that position, but they did. Then they were unfortunate with, as you say, they could have gone 4-1 up. But then from that point, you're watching the number of chances that Fulham created and how passive the defending was. Again, it's like there's too many, there's just a gulf. Like, they know that they're not as good as every opposition a lot of the time. And so the defenders are too scared to even, like engage. And sometimes when that's like a Traore or whatever, you can understand it because he's rapid. But to give Muniz that much room in the box, there's always that distance they don't want to be made a fool of, because they've been made a fool of so many times. There's still a massive gulf between them and everyone else really in the Premier League. Next season is a different matter. Chris Wilder will rip it up and make it his own. He's just come back from Saudi Arabia, where he's had a meeting with the owner about the future and plans and whatnot. I still have my doubts about that club, generally speaking, as long as he's the owner. But with Chris Wilder there, you would give them every hope of mounting another challenge next season.
Looking at the rest of the relegation battle then, Burnley on 18 points, Luton on 22, Forest on 22, Everton 25, Brentford 27. I'm bringing them into it just for a kind of complete round circle story, as we mentioned them so positively at the start. Does anyone see any of the more established clubs, and I say that only on the basis of that they were promoted for one season, swapping with Luton or Burnley? Alison, do you think Burnley have got a chance now, having slagged them off all season, then they prove you wrong?
Well, on the scales of Rudd slagging offness, no, I've slagged them off more than I've praised them. I think I would love it if that result at Stamford Bridge meant we saw something more resilient and that amount of energy from them. And if they escaped, I think it would be a wonderful, wonderful story. I'd love to eat lots of humble pie over Vincent Kompany, but it's probably unlikely, isn't it?
Might be a bit too late. Tony, 22 points, both for Forest and Luton. Could you see, which way do you see that one go?
Well, I'd like to think Forest have got more quality than they should have because they invested a hell of a lot of money. Luton play well and seem to be in games and then find a way of losing.
As they were against Tottenham.
Tottenham, and they've done it a few times. Obviously, the Bournemouth game pretty, you know, a few weeks ago. The one that's really surprising me is Everton. I just can't... They seem to not even be able to find a way of winning a game. Mm. And if you go through their team, the amount of leaders and internationals they've got in their side, and, you know, partnership of Tarkowski and Braithwaite. Braithwaite's just made his England debut. You know, I'm thinking, how are they... Number one, England goalkeeper in their goals. You know, I'm just thinking, how are Everton still... And they could have another deduction, which will put them in serious trouble.
Yeah,
Everton haven't won since 16th of December.
Hmm. Right, points deductions aside, Gregor, what, your former team, Nottingham Forest, to me there's something about them with the way the off-the-pitch stuff, Clattenburg complaining about referees, then the deduction. I mean, as a player, that can't be good. As much as Tony's saying about the quality that they've got over someone like a Luton, when you look at the teams and the atmosphere around the club, Luton are just this wonderful, plucky story of lots of different players, some who maybe don't, you know, deserve to be in the Premier League. I mean that, you know, in inverted commas. And then players like Ross Barkley who are playing out of their skin and showing their quality. Forest, it's the opposite of that, isn't it?
Yeah, but there's always this feeling that they have got, you know, they've got more quality than probably all the teams around them there. Certainly in attacking sense. Like someone to actually put the ball in the back of the net, Chris Wood. Although there was an interesting stat that he scored, what, has he scored 10 plus goals in five seasons since 2017-18, and there's the other players who've done that are like, you know,
yeah,
established strikers.
Sort of a Glenn Murray record, isn't it?
Yeah, look, if you've got a striker who'll score 10 goals every season in the Premier League, that's no mean feat. And he has like become the focal point. It was a great little finish that.
Yeah.
And when you've got Gibbs White, Hudson-Odoi, Alanga if he's fit, and you know they've got enough there. It's just conceding goals again. So like, I think it's going to be tight for them, but I think Forest, there's just always a feeling that Forest have a bit more quality than actually any of the other teams around them there.
It'll be tight indeed. Gregor Robertson, Alison Rudd and Tony Cascarino, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you too for listening. We've got more midweek action to come, so we'll be back on Thursday and I might make Gregor do some more predictions.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.